And we'll call the next case, Purvis versus Burnaby, 09-1098.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Unrath?
Yes. I represent Chief Burnaby, counsel. I'd like to start with the first day of Chief Burnaby's investigation. On that day, he heard a detailed account of a sexual affair between a high school sophomore and his biology teacher. He also learned that the grandmother had known about this affair for some time. The grandmother knew that the student had kissed the teacher, and she knew that the teacher had said that she loved the student. He learned that Gina Purvis, the teacher, had invited the student to her home while her husband was not there and had asked the student to lie to his parents about it to conceal the nature of the visit. Now, the following day, he engaged in a consensual overhear conversation. He had the victim's mother call the teacher, Gina Purvis. Listening in on this call was Chief Burnaby and a representative from the Department of Children and Family Services. I think it's important to point out that Chief Burnaby's report begins with the statement that Gina Purvis repeatedly denied that she had ever had sexual intercourse with Mickey Rebus.
She knew the others were listening in, right?
Gina Purvis did not. No.
When you say that over here, who is overhearing? The other people who were not on the phone, is that what that means?
Yes, it means that Marilyn Rebus, the victim's mother, called Gina Purvis.
Okay.
And that Chief Burnaby and the Department of Children and Family Services were listening in.
Okay.
Now, he reported that she denied ever having sex with Mickey Rebus. But she also mentioned that she had flirted with him, and she felt bad about that. She admitted that she told him that she loved him, and she admitted that she'd given him gifts. She admitted that they had kissed on one occasion, but it had happened so quickly she was apparently powerless to prevent it.
Is that in the closet of the science lab?
That's correct, Your Honor. She also, and I think this is important, she confirmed that she had indeed invited Mickey Rebus to her home while her husband was away, and she confirmed that she had instructed Mickey Rebus to lie to his parents about it, to tell his parents that he was actually there visiting her niece, Courtney, who was not actually in the home on that day. Now, many police officers, I believe, would find probable cause to arrest by that second day. But Chief Burnaby did not. He investigated further. And one good reason for investigating further is that he found out that Mickey Rebus had a cousin who Rebus said could verify everything. He knew all about the affair. Well, that cousin was submerged. He was in a submarine serving off the Middle East, which created some delay in contacting him. But it was also assurance that no one could have tampered with that witness. No one could have coached his cousin, Rick Andes. Now, while he's waiting for Rick Andes literally to surface, he subpoenaed the telephone records, and he found that Gina Purvis had initiated 380 phone calls, hundreds of phone calls, to Mickey Rebus over a three-month period.
Weren't some of those calls at 3 in the morning? I mean, there were some odd times.
Some very odd times. I think it's important to note some of the dates, too. There were, I believe, some 3 hours of conversation on Valentine's Day. Now, to be fair, many of these calls were listed as one-minute calls. They could have been leaving a message. We don't know how long, if they actually lasted a minute.
So you've identified all the evidence that you say supports Burnaby's call, but they point out a lot of things were inconsistent, and there were these credibility determinations and the fact that the DCFS investigator said she would have liked to have known about some of these credibility issues. How much did your client's investigation impact DCFS credibility, their findings, rather?
Well, for example, Judith O'Brien, we noted her testimony that she had found that there were that Gina Purvis was indicated for sexual molestation of a minor. Now, her conclusion was not issued until March of 2005, after the a couple of months after the arrest. But they asked her about this. They said, well, what about the fact that Mickey Rebus had been acting as an informant for the police? Does that change your view of things? And she said no. She said what counts here is that he gave a credible report to police, detailed report of sexual molestation. She could look him in the eye. She could see that he was telling the truth. He repeated that story consistently a few days later during a videotaped deposition, and a transcript of that deposition is included in the record on appeal. But in the end, I, quite frankly, am not concerned about the exculpatory evidence when you take into account the testimony or the report from the witness, Rick Andes. When his submarine finally did surface, Chief Burnaby was the first person allowed to speak to him the moment he got off the ship. And Rick Andes confirmed every aspect of Mickey Rebus' story. He said he had no doubt in his mind that a sexual affair had been going on. And they said, well, how do you know that? And he said, because Gina Purvis admitted it. She said he was good in bed.
When was she arrested?
She was arrested December 15th was when the indictment was handed down. I believe it was soon
after. This is after the grand jury hearing.
Yes.
And hand down an indictment.
Yes.
And the investigation, I understand, was in cooperation with the state's attorney, Herman. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And throughout. So the arrest was not until after all this investigation and the grand jury testimony and indictment.
The conversation with Rick Andes, who confirmed, who heard the perpetrator, alleged perpetrator, admit to the crime, occurred on December 4th of 2004. The indictment occurred about 11 days later.
Now, you're into your rebuttal time. You may want to keep going, but I just wanted to make you aware of that.
I understand, Your Honor. I'll try to be brief. I don't care whether other high school students believe these sexual rumors or not. I don't care whether we have a 10-carat necklace or a 14-carat necklace. I don't care whether we have computer records that could have added further ammunition to the prosecution's case. What I do care about is that we have a credible report from a victim, and we have that report verified, corroborated by witness.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Unwin. Mr. Farini?
Good morning, Your Honors. Joseph Farini on behalf of Defendants Appellants Daniel Oyst, Patricia Lawn, and Gary Vicini. May it please the Court. There are two steps to a qualified immunity analysis under Saussure, and both steps are lacking as to all three individual school defendants here. Under Pearson, this Court can address first whether plaintiff has shown that any purportedly violated right was clearly established in the context at bar. Indeed, in the Landstrom case, this Court went right to the clearly established issue and held that the cases the plaintiff cited did not establish anything that mandated an answer either way. As to the dean of students, he was in a meeting with a student said to be telling others that he had been in a sex relationship with a teacher. The dean had both the obligation to protect that student from predatory sex abuse under weighty state interests and the duty, as dean of students, to punish a false rumor-mongering student. That is the situation with which the dean was confronted.
Well, was there a standard procedure for dealing with sexual harassment claims by students?
That there would be an inquiry with the student.
Well, why were Vicini and Purvis treated so differently?
Why were Vicini and Purvis treated so differently?
Or do you think there was a difference?
There was a difference in the way that the situation was handled. I'm not sure what it has to the constitutional implications of what's going on here and the inquiry that occurred with the student. As far as the Vicini incident, you're dealing with a different situation. You did have a confrontation between the student and the teacher in question. I do note that Purvis was not in town at the time. She was away, that the superintendent tried to contact her and did not get an answer, that they then had an inquiry, or I'm not sure about the time of the phone call, but that they had an inquiry with the student then. Purvis was not present when they had the inquiry with the student.
How about the bias issue? She reported him to another incident the year before.
Well, the evidence in the record isn't, there's no evidence of actual bias. When they asked Purvis at her deposition, she couldn't come up with one instance of a dirty look, of a offhanded comment. The evidence of bias that the court...
Wasn't that a jury question, though?
But at the qualified immunity stage, we're looking at an objectively reasonable official and what an objectively reasonable official would do under the circumstances. And I would say to this court that when you have this official in these circumstances,
well,
when you have...
He was pretty unhappy that you reported him, wasn't he?
That's speculation. That's complete speculation.
I think he exhibited some indignation, didn't he, at the time?
Actually, with the student. The student was brought to him, and he said, "Ashley, I didn't do that." Now, if you can infer bias against the student from that, but to say that then goes to also to Purvis, I think that's too far of a leap.
Let me just get back to Purvis a minute. I thought there were sort of two segments to this. The first one, I don't remember, was in the spring, and another one in the fall.
That is correct.
What developed from the spring, whatever it was, when you had the denials?
What happened in the spring, Your Honor, is that this student was brought in to talk to the principal. The principal asked him a couple of times, a couple different ways. He said, no relationship. The principal said, okay, let it go. But now here you have, again, then in the fall, these same rumors. I mean, school officials have an interest in maintaining order and discipline within the school. And here you have a second occasion where these rumors are flying through the halls. It's the kid who has now been designated as the source of these rumors. The officials have a right to get to the bottom of this. And to just say that he should just, again, ask once or twice, did you do this? Okay, no, son, go on your way. I think I just don't think that's reasonable.
Well, see, and this gets back to the question I had before. What's the procedure for dealing with sexual harassment claims? Because in the first instance, when we were dealing with Vicini, there was the student told Purvis about Vicini's sexually harassing acts, and then Purvis told the principal. The principal then questions the student in Vicini's presence, never contacts the police, never contacts Family Services, DCFS. Totally different situation in this circumstance, and so that's something we do want to take into account, when you're looking at qualified immunity, what a reasonable person would do, sort of what's the procedure. So it doesn't sound like there's any, procedure or methodology to how you deal with these in the district. So nobody's quarreling with the fact that schools have to investigate, but we have to look at what was the process that was used, what are the procedures, that kind of thing. And it looks like you could have two students with completely and handle completely differently how the administrators deal with it.
Well, what you have required under the statute, Your Honor, is that if an official has reasonable cause to believe that they report it, what you have under Doe v. Domofsky case cited by the opposition, it makes clear that if you have rumors of a relationship, that the officials are to investigate. So once an official apparently has possession of this knowledge, the official is to investigate. Now, the dean of students...
There's no methodology with respect to the investigation. That hasn't been defined, the steps that need to be taken anywhere.
Well, not...
Find out, is there a protocol? Is it something in writing that talks about the investigative steps that need to be taken? I take it the answer is no. Right, the answer is no.
No, I don't. I am not aware.
You're real slow on your yes. and now, after your clients reported the incidents to the police, what role did they have in pursuing further investigations?
No role. No role
I'd
in pursuing.
I'd like to ask this question apropos of that. I mean, this goes to the question of whether there was a property interest requiring due process, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, the ANCRA statute has a provision that if a matter is reported to the DCFS as required under ANCRA, that information must be transmitted to some other school who is applying to hire the teacher by the superintendent of the district. It's an obligation. Now, if that information has to be transmitted to another school when the teacher is applying for another job, it obviously is going to be a very severe barrier to that teacher getting another job. Doesn't that create a sufficient interest to require some due process?
I see my time is up. Can I answer that?
Yes.
It does, and DCFS, under the statute, is the entity that is to provide the procedures. DCFS only investigates a third of the reports it receives. Then DCFS undertakes its investigation. It's important to note here that under Strasburger versus Board of Education, plaintiff has to show at the summary judgment stage that she was deprived of due process up until the point of the deprivation. The deprivation only occurs when DCFS indicates plaintiff. That's when the deprivation occurs.
I mean, there's a provision in the statute that requires the superintendent of the district to provide that information to some other place that she's applying for a job. Now, that affects her liberty interest and her profession, it seems to me.
That occurs upon indication.
Now, the indication is done by DCFS,
DCFS,
right?
DCFS
did not withdraw that, did she?
Well, DCFS has nothing to do with it. The superintendent has got to report the fact that he reported it to DCFS. That's part of the ANCRA statute.
That's not my understanding.
Mentioned, as I know, in the briefs. I don't believe, but it certainly is part of the statute.
There's no evidence of record that the superintendent went and reported this to other schools. That's for sure. So that's one thing. There's no evidence of record that the superintendent reported this to other schools.
He's required by law to report.
And he might be in derogation of the law, but if he didn't do it, that can't be used as a basis for saying he deprived her rights, something that he didn't do.
Are they obligated?
The DCFS is obligated upon indication. And that gets back to what I'm trying to make clear to this court, is that the DCFS afforded her notice, an opportunity to be heard. She declined that opportunity to be heard, but it afforded a full panoply of procedures, and it provided independent decision makers, who she has not alleged.
About something entirely different than I asked you a question about. I'm asking about the section that requires the superintendent of the district to inform other districts to whom the teacher may be applying about the fact that he has reported her to the DCFS.
And if that provision is in there, there's no evidence of record that the superintendent did that. If there's no evidence of record that he did an action, he might be in violation of that statute, but that doesn't violate her constitutional rights.
Comply with the law.
That doesn't violate her constitutional rights. We're here to determine whether her constitutional rights were violated. Not obeying the statute would not violate her constitutional rights.
Well, the issue is whether there's a there's a property interest involved. And that may be a liberty interest in this case if her future as a teacher is threatened.
The only evidence of record is that what happened was after indication by the DCFS, the DCFS went and posted on this website that they have to post it on. Your Honor, I'm making clear that there is no evidence of record that the superintendent went and told anybody.
Yeah, what Judge Cudahy is saying is if she applies for another job somewhere else, he's under an obligation to report it. Therefore, that obligation to report could prevent her from getting a job. Therefore, that might then have a constitutional implication.
It might
affect her property rights. That's your point. And you haven't answered that.
I have. At the summary judgment.
That's what you haven't answered. So you agree that it could potentially affect her property rights under the hypothetical we're giving you, assuming the superintendent complies with the law. it could affect her property rights because it would be posted and they would know she was charged with sexual harassment and therefore she might not get a position. That's what he's trying to get at. That has a potential, doesn't it, of affecting
her
property.
DCF may exculpate her subsequently.
Right.
Who knows about that? But I'm suggesting that the fact that she was reported might be an obstacle to many school districts to hire in the first place.
At the summary judgment stage, though, she has the burden of showing that this action was actually performed by the superintendent. You can't play in theoretical sphere here in this individual case. In this specific case, she, at the summary judgment stage, has to show that there's a deprivation. She has not shown that the superintendent went and talked to anybody at any point in time without that showing.
We understand your position. We don't need to go round and round on this. All right. You may be seated. I'll give you an extra minute.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Esposito.
May it please the Court, Nicholas Esposito for Gina Purvis. I have an answer.
Good.
Yes, you're right. And that is exactly what this is about. This is about somebody who can't in the future trust that if she wants to get a job, the superintendent won't deliver her record to somebody else. And think about Ost in this case. She told Ost, my husband and I are thinking of leaving the school district because he wants to start a goat farm near his dad's farm. Ost says, don't tell anybody. It leaks out to the kid. He calls her before November 10th and says, is this true? Are you leaving? I'm not going to talk about it now. Her husband answered the phone. He knew who was on the phone. Are you leaving? She says, we'll talk about it when we get back. He says, let the rumors fly. Where did that come from? So going back to your point, Your Honor, if something like a rumor of leaving a school could get back to a student under a confidentiality issue, what then can we expect for this teacher in the future when she wants to get a job? Of course it's going to be reported. It has to be reported.
Okay, so now let me ask you this. What due process procedures would your client like to see before authorities are alerted to suspected child abuse?
Well, she's going through that process right now. I think that the law requires a disclosure like any other type of an employment case of what a personnel file includes. You're talking about her in the future. What could we do to protect her from damage, Judge? I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, what process? We've determined that with respect to the school principal that there wasn't any standard in terms of what happened procedurally.
I can answer that factually. That's not true. There was a process. There was a process in the school's handbook. The principal developed it and wrote it. In the handbook, Judge, the process listed, the principal even listed a half a dozen to eight questions to ask a student in the situation where there's an alleged sexual abuse. It is there. But guess what? The principal didn't use it when she investigated the female student about Vicini. She didn't ask the girl the six or eight questions she wrote. Instead, she takes the girl to see Vicini. Vicini closes the door. She closes the door. He pounds on the table and says, I didn't do it. What type of sexual abuse investigation is that where the accuser gets to confront the student immediately? It's not in her book. There were rules. She had rules. The state law has rules. DCFS has rules all over the place. DCFS has trained people to do this. Ost testified he was never trained in sexual abuse investigation. Vicini said he was never trained in sexual abuse investigation. Lund said she, who wrote this book, was never trained in sexual abuse investigation. So if we look at each of the investigations, to your point about the different treatment of each of the students, or each of the situations, we have Lund investigating a female student's claim that Vicini put his finger between her track underpants and her skin. So Lund takes that student and brings her to the football coach, Vicini.
Now, is this when just the two of them were alone? Is that what you're saying?
Vicini, Lund, and the student were all in the room. Lund closed the door. She stayed in the room. The principal allowed the dean of students to stand, pound on the table, and shout at this female student, I didn't do that.
Well, no, before, what he did. Who was in the room when he did what he's, whatever he did?
This incident with the student? He invited, but they got new track they got new track uniforms. He invited the girls to come into his office. Yeah. He closed the blinds. He had two girls go in a room next to his office and put on the track uniforms. This particular girl and the other girl came out and walked around and showed him the uniform. And he put his she says he put his finger between her pants, called Reddy's, and her leg.
Yeah, my girls run track. I know what they wear. In my opinion, it isn't enough. But then that's
no, it's not.
No, but that's another subject. I have to say, maybe I'm alone in this, I just see this night and day. That what went on there and what is allegedly going on with Purvis.
Judge, but I'm not comparing the facts.
Well, somebody is. We keep bringing this up, but Bassini shouldn't have been in the room in the investigation.
No.
He's the dean of students. You know,
he wasn't the dean of students at the time of against him.
Okay, I thought that's what... I read that somewhere, maybe.
He was not. He was the football coach, and he was the athletic chairman. He was not the dean of students.
Okay.
After he was charged, they promoted him to dean of students.
Okay. Well.
True. So the reason this is important, though, goes to the issue of bias. So, Judge, I ask you, you're now sitting in a room questioning the now male student about the woman that he knows charged him. Now, let's go to the he knows for a minute. This is interesting. The law requires that you don't disclose the name of the reporter. Going back to the question about DCFS and the discussion about bringing in DCFS and letting DCFS do this and the suggestion that DCFS did all these things, in no investigation ever conducted by this school district, except one, when a teacher admitted to guilt, did they ever call DCFS. Never. They didn't in this case. They didn't with the female student. They didn't in the spring of 2004 when rumors came up about this case. They never called DCFS.
The first time?
The first time, the second time, ever.
Well, how did DCFS get involved?
They did their own investigation.
Well, who reported it to him?
The chief.
Chief.
So they told the chief. He reported to the DCFS. My point is, Bassini and Ost conducted the DCFS investigation. The statute doesn't say they should do that. Although I thought of this question. What is the fine line? When do you decide? What is the duty of the superintendent, the principal, and the dean of students? When do you decide when you have enough information to report?
Yeah,
what do you have to do?
And that gets us to the, you know, because on this immunity business, you know, we have to look at this, what established right to due process procedures she would have. So you should spend some time on, you know, trying to point us to case law or, some, you know, what you think your best case is, because the cases you have in your brief, are different scenarios in our scenario, or maybe I'm
Levinstein is the principal case. Excuse me, Judge. Levinstein is the principal case that suggests that where there's a sham investigation, where there's a biased investigation, there is a due process right that's implicated here. And in this case, our statement to the lower court and the court agreed that where you have somebody who was charged by the same teacher with sexual abuse, now investigating that very teacher, there's inherent bias. How could he not be biased? How can he not remember when he's thinking about whether or not this teacher committed the same act he was charged with or a similar act he was charged with? She's the one that caused me all that grief. He was punished. He was punished.
Why isn't the superintendent immune? He didn't know anything about this conflict of interest problem.
Interesting question, and we've struggled with that. But we think he is not immune because he observed he took over this investigation from who I believe should have been DCFS. He observed the manipulation and the threats to the kid. Now, in and of themselves, there's case law that says threats and those other things may not be enough to get past qualified immunity. But he did one more thing. After he reported it to the police reported it to DCFS, which, by the way, didn't do any investigation. He reported it to DCFS, or the chief did. The superintendent then says to DCFS Judy O'Brien, Judy, you better re-interview this kid for now the fourth time before he recants, parenthesis, and says, it didn't happen. Remember that in the spring he said it didn't happen. Twice to Osten Vecini he said it didn't happen. They threatened him with arrest and suspension. Okay, oh, and it's confidential, and nothing will happen to you. Well, here's my get-out-of-jail-free card, you bet. It happened. Then he tells Judy O'Brien, hey, you better get him on record real quick because he might recant and say it didn't happen. That goes, in my mind, that goes to his thought of credibility at the very moment, the credibility of this kid that he had to threaten to say it did happen. To me, that suggests that he believed the kid lacked credibility, period. He is the top decision maker in the school. He's the one that must know and should know. You contact DCFS. You let this happen. He knew the kid lacked credibility. What's important about that is, because of his question to Judy O'Brien, he never told the chief. He never told the prosecutor. He never told Judy O'Brien. He never told the defense. He never told anybody that he felt the kid lacked credibility in that meeting that they had with him. And we think that implicates the superintendent as well. So the lower court focused on bias, and particularly with one not telling Ost that Vecini shouldn't be there, and bias with respect to Vecini knowing he shouldn't be there but doing it anyway and his inherent bias. The court doesn't necessarily say that bias absolutely relates to Ost. What I'm suggesting to the court is his knowledge of the process or what the process should be, his understanding of the kid's lack of credibility implicates him and keeps him the case.
Can we move to
yes,
Burnaby for a minute? Because he had Rebus's statement, and he had the corroborating phone records with these hundreds of phone calls. Wouldn't a prudent officer have reason to believe a crime occurred?
Judge,
the other things as well, but those are two critical things.
Thank you for asking, because there are many things that I'd like to talk about with respect to their presentation. But let's talk about what happened before the first day. They talk about the first day. First day is when the chief finds out from Ost and Vecini that the kid has a problem with the teacher. 2 days before that, this kid was a snitch for that police department. He did his first bust. The kid will tell you that the chief signed off on him being a snitch. So I'm going to just throw this umbrella idea out here because it's what we believe happened. The prosecutor, during the course of this investigation, the chief says to the prosecutor, can I meet with you? We've got to talk about Mickey being a snitch. Prosecutor says, I don't think you should use him anymore unless you think you have to. That's what he testified to. And what happens? The chief allows the kid to be a snitch, drug busting through the LaSalle County Drug Enforcement Bureau 9 more times through the trial date and several times before the grand jury ever hears from the chief. Chief doesn't tell the grand jury a thing about that. So if you look at all of these things that the chief did or didn't do, and they talk about, well, so what if he didn't exactly forensically test the room, which he never did until 9 months later. Think about it all in the context of whose interest, what interest is he trying to protect here? He's got his, I'm going to loosely call him his employee. Conflict of interest? Is he trying to protect the kid? Every time, when Judy O'Brien of DCFS wanted to interview the kid, can't do it without Burnaby. When they did the videotape of the kid, oh, you can all watch on TV. I have to be the one asking him the questions. In the interview, he tells the kid to take his hat off. So much for sensitivity to somebody who's a subject of sexual abuse. They have a relationship. They have such a relationship that 30 days before the trial, the chief secretly, without disclosure to the prosecutor or the defense, says, Mickey, 9 times one night in a couple hours is incredible. That's their relationship. Mickey comes into the chief's car in front of his house. Mom and dad don't even know about it. Mickey, you're not credible, he says. And going back to the points that were raised earlier in your questions and the points about the phone records, there are a lot of, I have a lot of respect for all the counsel here, but there are statements or things missing here. With respect to the overhear, the statement was made, DCFS was there listening in. DCFS didn't listen in. Burnaby didn't have DCFS listen in. DCFS, the day after this kid says, I'm abused, says, hey, Mom, I'm going to give you a handwritten list of questions, which, by the way, have never surfaced. Here's what I want you to ask the teacher. The teacher denied sex throughout the whole thing. DCFS did not listen in. The chief took sparse notes, doesn't know what happened to those, and there's testimony about conflicting things that were said about that conversation. With respect to the phone calls, there were 300 phone calls made by this kid in the same exact period of time of the alleged sex dates to this lady's niece in out of state. The kid sent a videotape to that same niece out of state. We asked the chief to prosecute him for sending an obscene videotape that had obscene. He took the videotape of he and his friends doing grotesque sexual things. He sent it to her. So this kid, so that's 600 phone calls now to her, to the niece. He's in love with the niece. The thing about the phone calls, too, though, a point well taken is by counsel about the 1 minute. The phone calls really we don't know what they prove, and we don't know that they exactly say what they're alleged to say. I have to talk about Andy's, though, Judge, please.
Yeah, I'll give you 2 minutes because we went 2 minutes over with them.
Okay. Andy's is critically important. Andy's is the cousin. Yes, he was on a submarine. God bless him. He gets off the submarine. Let's talk about how he even knew about it in the first place. Right after the kid meets with Burnaby, Burnaby says, don't call Purvis. Yes, I won't call Purvis. You know what the first thing he does is? He calls Purvis and says, I got to warn you. They made me say that I had sex with you. You know who he calls next? The task force. You know who he calls next? His cousin on the ship's girlfriend in New York the same day. What's that about? Can't we infer that maybe he was trying to say, hey, here's what happened, here's what I said, here's what you got to say. Andy's testified.
What is the evidence that the cousin got the call or got the word on the ship?
We don't know. We don't know.
Evidence that there was
the inference is that he made the effort to try and contact the cousin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but as I understand it, the chief questioned the cousin the moment he got off the boat.
No, Judge, they are allowed.
Here's what we found about. There was no opportunity to.
That's not true. Here's what we found out about submarines and boats. Submarines dock at bases. When they dock at bases, they can go on the internet and they can call on cell phones. They can't tell anybody where they are. Cell phones are a little more tricky because with GPS, somebody could locate where that submarine is, and for security purposes, we want to do that. They have secured website capability. He can contact his cousin. And his cousin destroyed 16,000 computer records, or Mickey. Rebus destroyed 16,000 computer records from his home computer after the charges were made. But if I can just get to Andy's and the nine times and all that stuff. Andy said, Mickey told me that he was having sex with Gina in January. He told the chief that prior to the grand jury. Mickey said, I never had sex with her until the second week of February. So the chief knows. Andy said Mickey said he had sex in January. Mickey says, I don't have sex until the second week. Stark contrast in when it first began. Mickey contends that he had sex with her at her house. The contention is that he was being picked up by friends. The point is, Andy pulls up to pick him up at her house. Andy says, this is it. Andy says, I saw them French kissing on her porch. Rebus says, I was in the house. We had been watching a baseball movie or a rodeo movie called 8 Seconds, and I was half asleep. I did not go outside when Andy's arrived. The chief knew the testimony of Andy's and the statement of Mickey before he went to the grand jury.
I want to ask a question on another point. Judge Mim found that the school investigation involved an interest requiring due process because it tainted the subsequent investigations. Is that correct?
Yes.
It tainted the DCSF and it tainted the police investigation.
Yes.
And I think that the evidence of that is rather thin. I've suggested another basis for it, for the due process implications of the school investigation, because of this requirement that the chief report to a school district that the teacher is applying to. That seems to me a better way to go if you're going to analyze that problem. But can you comment on this business of why this investigation tainted the subsequent investigations?
Yes, Judge.
It seems to me they were independent intervening things that probably removed the due process requirement from the first investigation.
Thank you. I'm happy to do that because there's a parallel situation for Burnaby and for the school employees. Both of them were inherently biased before they ever started. You don't even have to put the kid in the seat and ask him questions during the school investigation. Vicini's biased. Lund is biased. Lund doesn't tell Oates, you shouldn't have this guy sitting here interviewing the kid. She accused him. We don't even have to talk about what happened. We just, as a matter of common sense, I would say, and the Supreme Court has said this, somebody who's been accused by somebody else is now caused to interview a crime against that person. That inherent, so let's say that if after the second time, that's why this is so subjective. What if the superintendent said, okay, he denied it in the spring, he's now denied it twice, that's it, over. You're in trouble, you're suspended for spreading false rumors about a teacher. He could have stopped after the kid's first denial to the superintendent. He could have stopped right there. If it was truly just an investigation of potentially punishing a kid for spreading a rumor, he could have stopped it then. He could have stopped it the second time. What caused them to say, now wait a minute, okay, you're going to be arrested, suspended, we're going to promise you confidentiality, and nothing's going to happen to you if you say it happened. How is that? So the foundation of the entire investigation is this. If after the first time or second time the kid said nothing happened, case over. We're not going to the police. We're not going to DCFS because they never went to DCFS anyway. They were the ones that ultimately decided what would go to DCFS or not factually based on their own investigation. Once he could have said no. It's random. Judge, to your question, it's totally random at that school. There's no consistency in what they do. With respect to Burnaby, what we're suggesting is that he's inherently biased as well because of his relationship with the kid as a snitch. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Unrath, I'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First off, I just would like to respond to the consensual overhear call. This is from page 13 of the police report. Chief Burnaby said that he engaged in a consensual overhear. Present also was Pecchio. David Pecchio was a representative from the Department of Children and Family Services. As to Rick Andes and whether it is even possible that anyone could have communicated with him, the court should be aware of the fact that the Chief Burnaby arranged specifically with the United States Navy that he would be cut off from all communication. He ensured that Chief Burnaby would be the first person to speak with Rick Andes the moment he got off his submarine.
And all communications, you mean by that, computers as well?
Absolutely, Your Honor. He was cut off, and that's what he asked for. The Navy agreed to it. The point is this, Your Honor. In every criminal investigation, you will find exculpatory evidence. You will find witnesses whose credibility can be attacked. But when you have a victim of sexual molestation who gives a statement to police, who then a few days later gives the same consistent statement to the Department of Children and Family Services, and then has a witness, a credible witness, state that he heard the perpetrator, alleged perpetrator, admit to the crime. Your Honor, we have probable cause to arrest. If there is an officer anywhere in this country who would not arrest under that evidence, I don't want that officer working in my community. I do not want that officer protecting my grandchildren. The basic rule of law is that the shield of immunity will only be lost where the warrant is so lacking in indicia of probable cause that belief in its existence is unreasonable. How can we possibly disagree on the fact that where we have a witness who corroborates, who heard a perpetrator admit to the crime, probable cause exists as a matter of law? Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. You are out of town, but I'll give you 2 minutes.
One, I would like to clear up with the anchor statute section referred to. Your Honor, that statute says that the superintendent must let other district know if DCFS indicates the plaintiff. Does not happen before. Does not happen at the initial reporting. It is upon indication that the superintendent is to perform that. Therefore, I stand by my position that under Strausberger, they needed to show at the summary judgment stage that the procedures in place by DCFS before DCFS indicated her as a sexual abuser needed to be deficient. These were independent investigations, and contrary to what the opposition says, DCFS did perform an investigation at which notice, opportunity to be heard, and the panoply of procedures were provided before it indicated her, and then, yes, after indication, a superintendent is to pass that along to other school districts. That's after the deprivation, after the indication. Then going to the Levinston, I want to clarify, there are two Levinston cases cited. One is a Northern District decision, which this court has said district court decisions do not clearly establish rights. That's the Boyd case. Do not clearly establish rights under the law. Therefore, they can only rely on the Seventh Circuit Levinston decision, which is wholly in opposite. You're dealing with a situation where the man in question was refused to allow people, they did not let him be heard or present witnesses to the appeal panel, as was his right under school procedures. They discussed the merits of the case repeatedly with the appeal panel. They doctored the statements of people that he had allegedly harassed to transform the statements from generalized allegations of bad character to sinister allegations of sexual harassment. I mean, you cannot say that they would look at this case and use that as the guide for their actions and be able to say, look, and this gets to another point, the first time, it's okay to ask two questions of this kid and say, okay, Johnny, go on your way, fine. At some point, the school, in its interest in maintaining order and discipline, has to say enough is enough, and they can question, they should not, it's ludicrous, in my opinion, to require them to say, did you do it? Are you sure? No. Okay. Even though this all happened before, this is coming up again. This is before us. We're going to just go ahead. We have no interests in maintaining order here at this school. Plus their duties as mandatory reporters. They needed to get to the bottom of this, and I don't think that it's a clear constitutional violation, whatever you may allege is his bias.
We're going to stop there. Your
Thank
time.
You, Your Honor.
Also, were you talking about Section 4 of ANCRA?
Yes, Your Honor. What you refer to, the superintendent upon DCFS indicating, that is when that occurs. It does not happen before.
Any language about DCFS indicating anything?
Your Honor, it's after a finding is made. Perhaps that is the term, finding. But I would ask that this...
I'll read it to you, but we haven't got time for that.
I would ask that this court look closely at that statute provision because it is upon indication. Thank you, Your Honors.
Well, do you want to ask him more?
Oh, hell, I don't think
so. All right, I don't need my phone. All right, the court will stand in recess, take a brief recess, and we'll return for the third case.